Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. All right. Thank you for being here this morning. Before we go on the record, I want to talk with you a little bit about all the new technology in our courtroom and how to use it and what to expect, and then we'll have everybody enter appearances. So within the last summer, we upgraded our courtroom to speech-to-text technology. So whatever you speak into a live microphone, our software is populating a transcript in real time for us. When the light on your microphone is white, it's hot, and it's going to record everything you say. As soon as we begin the argument, our bailiffs will mute counsel table's microphones. You'll see the light go red. If you need to override that, press the little button on the speakers, and it will become a live mic again, as long as you're holding the button. We are also live streaming the argument. That is something that we're able to do now out of this courtroom. We love that technology and that ability. And I think that's it. We don't have any exhibits that are being presented today, correct? Okay. Good. Well, with that, we'll call the case. We're here on the matter of the state of New Mexico versus Carlos Sanchez Trillo, case number A1CA41279. Counsel, may we have your appearances, please.
Matthew James Edge on behalf of appellant Carlos Sanchez Trillo.
Thank you.
Lee Green for the state.
Thank you very much. Mr. Edge, are you reserving any time for rebuttal in your argument?
Yes, Your Honor, 10 minutes.
Thank you very much. That's so noted. All right, counsel, if we're all ready, whenever you are ready, please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. So the court came prepared with questions, and they're really great questions, so I think I'll begin by going through those questions one by one. And the first question is, the crime of conspiracy for distribution, does it require a intent of to distribute a further distribution beyond seller to buyer? And I think the answer to this is that yes, it does, simply because without that, all you have is a conspiracy to possess. If there's no, it's the buyer's conspiracy to possess. There's no further conspiracy to distribute this to anyone else. And in fact, so I would say that's the case here. Now, whether or not there's evidence in this record for that, I think that that's lacking here. What the state does have is a series of phone calls, supposedly between Carlos and several people on the outside. And in the course of those calls, the phone is apparently handed off to different inmates during that time. And they're also communicating with this person. But the state's theory at trial is to try to put all of this on Carlos and that he is the sole person who's making these transactions as far as we know. So I think that the state has failed with respect to proving that aspect of the conspiracy.
Counsel, does defendant have to share the intent to distribute beyond himself, past himself as a buyer, or can he just participate and further seller's intent to distribute to buyer?
Yeah. Your Honor, I think I would reject that theory simply because it would swallow the crime of possession. Any time that someone wants to buy drugs, even for themselves or for personal use, it becomes a conspiracy to distribute.
And I think that was one of the concerns that this court had when reviewing the use of a conspiracy charge in this way. But then reviewing State versus Silvis, it's a New Mexico Supreme Court 2015 NMSC 006, we have a very similar fact pattern where we have a singular transaction between a buyer and a seller. And in that case, the seller was the one that was charged with the conspiracy and then the transferring charge. Mm-hmm. So we have similar charges, trafficking and conspiracy. And it evaluated those charges under double jeopardy and concluded because both had been charged, you only get one. There's double jeopardy based on the same factual predicate. Here, we only have the conspiracy charged based on the intent to distribute theory. And it's a lesser offense, if I'm understanding correctly, than the actual possession charge. If defendant had possessed, it's a higher degree felony than if he had simply been convicted of conspiracy, third degree versus fourth degree. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure I see the problem. If they charge both, it's double jeopardy. If they only charge one, as they did in this case, it's a lesser degree offense. So what's the problem with that structure, that charging structure?
I guess the problem I'm having with this is that it's one thing to charge the distributor or the seller with a conspiracy to distribute for selling to a defendant. But I guess I would draw the line at trying to pull those charges on the buyer, simply because in that case it does tend to swallow the possession, whereas that's not really the concern if you're charging the buyer. If the court is not having a problem with that aspect of it, then I don't know that there would be a double jeopardy problem between a conspiracy to distribute and a conspiracy to possess. But I think there would still be, in this case, a double jeopardy problem between the conspiracy charge and the accessory liability.
Sticking with the conspiracy for a moment, okay. Please push back at me if you okay. think that my understanding is incorrect. But I had thought a conspiracy means that both members of the conspiracy share the same intent to commit a felony. And if that's the case, why don't we have the same intent for the buyer and the seller in a transaction involving the sale of drugs?
Well, I think that the idea is that we're just looking at it from the person who means to distribute the drugs as opposed to the person who means to acquire them. And ultimately, I think, definitionally, I think you probably, you know, it's probably the case that you can analytically just swallow these up if one wishes. I think that, like I said, with respect to the buyer, it does tend to swallow the idea of possession to that any particular attempt to purchase drugs would be a conspiracy under this theory.
Counsel, would you be concerned, say that this court does say, you know, that the buyer can somehow be part of this conspiracy to distribute because they are conspiring to purchase the drugs from the distributor, which I hear what you're saying, right? It kind of swallows the concept. Are you concerned at all about how DA's offices would move forward with charging people who would normally receive a possession charge with conspiracy to traffic, even though the conspiracy would be a fourth degree versus a third degree possession?
I think, you know, first of all, it's not just merely the severity of the offense. There are also differences in the elements that have to be proved. So, and it's difficult to assess prospectively how that might happen. I guess my fear would be is that even though it is a lesser offense, it is an inchoate offense. It is a potentially nebulous offense. And, you know, so I think that is problematic in and of itself. You know, there are certain kinds of defenses that would be available to an attempted possession charge that would not be available in conspiracy. And so I don't know, it's kind of a devil's bargain, I guess. You know, a lesser severity, but easier to prove.
Well, it seems strange, right, for mm-hmm. somebody who's trying to purchase drugs to then be part of a conspiracy of distribution when they are not the person distributing, just the person attempting to purchase.
Yes, Your Honor, it would be. And I guess that's really kind of the sort of analytic problem that I have with it. And, you know, the other thing, too, is that conspiracy potentially opens conspirators to other kinds of liability as well. You know, for instance, there's a potential for RICO liability or other things like that. If you prove the existence of a criminal conspiracy as a predicate, then that opens up the defendant and, not just the defendant, but, the other defendants in the case to other kinds of liability as well. So
I'm having trouble understanding why we think the seller can be part of a conspiracy, but why we think the buyer couldn't.
I think that the fundamental nature is that a buyer who, I guess, an end user purchaser, they may be selling, they may be sharing the distributor's intent, but I think it is analytically a somewhat different intent. It's that intent to acquire, and obviously that requires a reciprocal distribution from someone else. But I think that's just, I think that's something different. And I think if I'm simply trying to acquire drugs, that doesn't necessarily entail any further distribution or further social harm. And I guess, the other thing is that this is kind of grouping, low-level drug dealers in with people who are simply, trying to purchase for personal use.
But I understand where you're coming from. Yeah. That makes sense to me. But then why would we say that the seller has entered into a conspiracy with a shared intent? Why could the seller then get that charge? If I'm understanding you correctly, it's that there's not actually a shared intent between the buyer and the seller. And in that case, that tells me a conspiracy would not be formed because there's not the same intent to commit the crime. And so I'm having trouble understanding why we think a seller could be a conspirator but not the buyer.
Yeah, I guess the best answer I can give you, Your Honor, is that if the court decides to make an analytical distinction between these two, it could base it on this, in that that desire to acquire or that intent to acquire is just not the same as the distributor or the seller's intent. The seller usually doesn't care, who they're buying from. They just want to acquire the drug from whatever source. And therefore, I think the idea is that they just want to acquire, and that obviously requires a distribution, but I don't know that they're necessarily sharing that seller's particular intent. I don't.
Can you, I'm sorry, go ahead. I was wondering about the evidence of intent in this case.
Okay, yes. Like I said, the evidence of this mostly comes in from a series of phone calls or jail phone calls. And in the course of those phone calls, the state is alleging that Mr. Sanchez Trio hands the phone to other inmates during the course of those calls. And in fact, the defense theory is that these calls were actually placed by other inmates using Mr. Sanchez Trio's account. However, I don't think that in any of these other, when he's handing off these phones to the other inmates, they don't appear to be making a common deal with Mr. Sanchez Trio. And in fact, it's the state's theory that Mr. Sanchez Trio is acting alone with respect to this, and that he's not a part of a conspiracy. They want to, they're trying to attack the defense theory that this was actually carried out by other people. So I don't know that the evidence of further distribution is present, or of an intent for further distribution is present in this case, Your Honor.
Understanding the specifics of this case, one of the thoughts that keeps coming to mind is, okay, in this case, if we were to say that the defendant is guilty of the conspiracy to distribute, and we are localized to just the six box of strips in this case, but let's imagine that the person who brought the Suboxone to the jail also had multiple other letters to other inmates. How would a conspiracy charge work with that in terms of who's responsible for what quantity of dope, right? Would we then be looking at the conspiracy of responsibility for all of the dope that went to the jail, just to the individual people who were attempting to possess it? Mm-hmm. Like, how do we deal with intent with, as you mentioned earlier, somebody who's like, I don't care who I get it from, I'm just trying to get what I want for me, not being aware that the person who's distributing is actually distributing in a far greater amount into other individuals that they might not be aware of.
Well, I I must confess I am very stumped, and I'm trying to go back to 2L, and I think the answer to this is that is essentially the chain rule, that there are, you know, rules in jurisprudence which limit the scope of potential conspiracies for co-conspirators. I think that the rule is that we only consider the agreement that the defendant had with the, you know, with the co-conspirator. I think there that might get changed a little bit if the defendant has knowledge of the other other conspiracies, and there's some kind of evidence that the defendant's particular conspiracy and somehow reinforced or contributed to the other conspiracies. So I think that's kind of the short answer, which I know is unsatisfactory because it plays out a lot of different ways in a lot of different cases. But I think that's kind of what it is. And getting back to the amount in distribution, I think that, you know, honestly, the, you know, in every case, we can always consider the amount in question as part of the factual question of, is this meant for further distribution or for personal use? And then I think, once again, those factors play in, right? I mean, and I think they're a little bit looser in this case than if it was an evidentiary concern than a chain rule concern. Because under that second theory of whether or not the defendant has knowledge of these other conspiracies and knowledge specifically of whether their particular agreement with the co-conspirators is abetting these other conspiracies, then I think that may be, you know, something to consider. Like, for instance, you could have a smuggling ring where, you know, we intend to send in a whole bunch of Suboxone strips, but we're only going to send them 6 strips at a time because we know some of them will get intercepted or something like that. And then they're meant to be, you know, consolidated and distributed on the inside. There's no evidence of that particular fact pattern here, but we could imagine that would happen, Your Honor. I guess that brings us to the court's second question about the differences of these statutes. And I want to point out that there are two main distinctions between 14A and 14B. And the one of them that we've discussed a lot in the briefing already is grounds versus confines. And this is a distinction that was baked into the statute since before the 1953 compilation, at least. And it's also interesting to note that when they passed 14.1 in 1997, they adopted the confines language of 14A, but they didn't amend 14B. They kept that distinction. And I should point out that this is not just a distinction between grounds and confines, but it's also a distinction between the actus reus in the offenses, in that bringing contraband into a prison is defined as carrying, transporting, or depositing onto the grounds, whereas 14B only talks about carrying contraband into the confines of a jail. So, I think that the legislature meant a real distinction between these based on the kinds of functions that these facilities carry out. And the main one is that simply that people in prison, they've already been convicted, they're serving a sentence. People in jail, that's pre-adjudication. And even if they're in pretrial detention, they still have or should have like extended visitation rights and things like that to confer with co-counsel and things like that. And I think this also harkens back to probably a period when our public architecture was a little bit more primitive. I mean, I think we all imagine like sort of Mayberry and, you know, the jail there. You have, I can't even remember the name of the guy, but Andy Griffith, the sheriff. And, you know, this is a one-room jailhouse, right? I mean, it's literally his desk, and then, you know, in the corner they have, you know, a cell. And so I think in that makes that kind of distinction makes sense in that kind of context, because, you know, you're going to have things entering the jail, which, you know, is maybe not designed with the kind of segregation of functions that you might see in a more modern detention facility. But I think, you know, this is an important thing to make in as much as the people who were in jail are still under not as quite the level of restriction of liberty as people who are in prison.
But what do you think the problem is? If we agree that there is a distinction between A and B, that he was essentially charged and convicted for B with A's elements,
yeah.
Is it a sufficiency problem? Is it an instructional error? Is it a charging problem? What is this?
This is where it gets interesting.
Agree.
So I think this is where it goes. This is where it comes to, and it has to do with whether or not we're judging sufficiency against the jury instruction versus the statutes, or versus the elements in the statute. And I think usually we go with the language of the jury instruction simply because when we're doing that kind of sufficiency analysis, there's an underlying double jeopardy concern. Even if the instructions are in some way defective, we still need to know whether or not there's sufficient evidence to retry the person. I think, however, in this kind of case, you have to look at the statutory definition as well, simply because the instruction was defective in a way that diluted the state's burden and allowed theories of conviction that the language of the statute wouldn't support. So, and I think that's kind of the distinction that, you know, the court had that concern in Rozier concerning, you know, the even if the instruction is defective with respect to the willfulness element, we still look at the other elements of the crime to see whether or not there's sufficient evidence to retry. In this case, I think you can go ahead and look at that additional evidence, but because of the type of deficiency in the instruction here, you have to actually look at the statutory language. And I think under that, then the evidence falls short on both the distinctions in the statute. For one, there's really no evidence of carrying. There is evidence that the evidence is that the contraband was put into the United States mail. It was deposited in the United States mail, and it was delivered to the facility. So that's not, you could argue that that's not carrying or that's not carrying. You could argue maybe it's depositing or transporting. But that's not under that language of the statute.
All right, Mr. Edges, yes, your time is up. I'm going to ask you to wrap it up unless colleagues have any additional questions.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And, counsel, we'll add about a minute onto the clock to equalize the time.
May it please the court. With respect to the court's first question, the state's position is an established one. Intent for conspiracy is two-part. First, an intent to agree, and then a shared intent to commit the offense. Intent is shared at the time of the agreement, and in this case, sufficient evidence was presented to the jury to establish both of those intent requirements. In regards to some of the questions that the court has asked earlier, the state does not have to prove that there was an independent subsequent sale by defendant to other individuals who were detained at the same facility. The inquiry is simply that the defendant shared the seller's intent at the time of the agreement to distribute. And here the evidence did permit that that inference, because both of them knew each other, both of them had lived in the same pod at the jail together, and discussed repeated structural transactions involving installment payments and coordinated delivery.
So your position is that defendant had not the intent to purchase, or even separate from the intent to purchase, he shared seller's intent to sell to defendant because he had this intent to purchase.
No, not because he had an intent to purchase. He had a shared intent to distribute. Traditionally, traditional indicators for intent on trafficking and distribution are identical jury instructions, except the only difference is the schedule of the drug. Mm-hmm. But traditional indicia for trafficking is the amount. You've got street value as testified by an expert. There's express statements under Chavez and Vankert and Flores. There's fleeing law enforcement officer, again under Chavez. There's presence of a cutting agent or scales, or if there's a gun and cash, individual baggies, all of those types of things are traditional indicia of distribution. However, here what we have is market-based indicia of distribution. We've got quantity inferences with repeated ongoing shipments. We've got inferences of the resupply model consistent with resale. We've got inferences of standardized transactional units. In one of the phone calls, the defendant said, "I usually take 5. That's a quantity per shipment on a distribution cycle.
Do you need expert testimony on quantity to be able to associate quantity with intent to traffic or distribute?
Traditionally, yes, expert testimony is used. However, there was no expert testimony here, and I don't know that an expert would have said that 6 Suboxone strips was beyond personal use, and the facts aren't in this particular case. But that is only one indicator for the intent to distribute.
But I guess, does that actually matter if we have an intent for the seller to distribute to the buyer? Like, does quantity matter under the circumstances?
So the unique circumstances of this case, what differentiates it between a drug sale on a street corner or at a park is that it's happening within a jail. And contraband in a jail is the jury can reasonably infer that that is going to be recirculated.
Even if it wasn't recirculated, even if it was defendant using for himself, buying from the seller and using personally, what for the conspiracy to stand, I think what we're looking at is the intent to distribute. And per the state's theory at trial, it's the seller's intent to distribute to defendant.
So there was additional evidence presented that the Exhibit 10, which had the envelope of the Suboxone mailed to defendant, there were other envelopes that were mailed by seller to other individuals who were also simultaneously detained with defendant.
But don't we have in closing argument the state focusing the jury on the transaction between seller and defendant?
He focused his argument on the multiple phone calls and their arrangements. But there is an implied inference there because of that marketing structure, repeated sales, scheduled distribution.
But so to be clear, you're making a distinction between somebody selling drugs to someone on the street corner, just like a hand-to-hand purchase, versus the situation here where you're saying that there's inferences of a structure, right, of how the dope was to be obtained and potentially distributed throughout the jail for conspiracy. So I guess what I'm asking is to clarify, the state is not arguing that a hand-to-hand buy on a corner between a seller and a buyer could create a conspiracy charge.
Correct. So State v. Pinson is on point with that, as well as... One moment, let me find the right page. State v. Pinson and State v. Sandoval, both of them say that New Mexico has decided to ascribe more criminal liability to the seller than to the buyer. So if that transaction had occurred on a street corner and there were not recurrent payments, or other scheduled distribution. And the only thing that we plucked from this case is that we take the envelope of Suboxone and put it on a street corner, then defendant would not be liable for conspiracy because there's no phone calls, there's no scheduled distribution, there's no payments, there's no repeated actions on his part. If it's one sale on a street corner, then he would be guilty, appropriately charged and found guilty of possession of a controlled substance, whereas the seller, it would be for distribution.
I guess just to further ask along this line, so say if it was a hand-to-hand buy and we know that this person purchased user quantities once or twice a month for 6 months from this person, would that then qualify as conspiracy?
Pinson and Sandoval are quite clear that the buyer and individual sales are not subject to criminal liability for distribution.
Thank you.
Further questions about the conspiracy?
I want to point out in the brief, I'm looking at page 5.
Of the brief in chief or answer brief?
Your answer brief.
Okay.
The bottom of that paragraph, your brief acknowledges the state prosecutor argued that defendant was guilty of conspiracy to commit distribution of a controlled substance because defendant agreed with Robert Russell to have Robert Russell transfer to him, i.e. to himself, defendant, the 6 strips of Suboxone intercepted by the detention center. So how do we get off the state's position below that the conspiracy simply involved a transaction between seller and defendant?
If you listen to, there is a transaction between seller and defendant, that the wholesale supplier and defendant, but that is not the only interaction. There are multiple interactions, there are multiple payments, there was multiple promises of delivery, and there were multiple schedules for delivery. On the jail phone calls, you can hear the wholesale supplier saying, I'm going to send 2, I'm going to wait to send these other ones.
I'll submit to you that we've listened to the jail phone calls, and to me, they don't strike me as terribly clear.
Jail calls are a beast unto themselves. But just to clarify, while we were there briefly, opposing counsel mentioned that there was multiple inmates on the phone calls. That's slightly a mischaracterization of the evidence. There's one other individual besides defendant and the wholesale supplier. His name is Gordo, and they talk about him in a couple of conversations, and his voice is mentioned in one of the phone calls. But if you look at the phone calls from a market perspective, you've got staggered delivery dates, you've got repeated sales, you have structure as to resupply.
That is such an organized way of saying what was happening in those 7 calls, because what I was sort of hearing was defendant continuously calling saying, I haven't gotten my stuff, and the guy on the other end saying, oh yeah, I'll take care of it, I'll get it out tomorrow, I'll do it right now. It was never clear to me these were all individual requests or follow-up requests. And it sounds like you're asking us to infer from the calls that because it was in a jail and because we heard defendant ask on the phone and the seller said he was going to send stuff, that there must have a conspiracy to distribute in the jail must have existed.
There was more than one payment. There was more than one delivery. One of the deliveries went to a different detainee. There was more. The conversations between the two support that they were in regular communication. He knew his telephone number. They knew the detainee's identification number. There's markers that it was an ongoing business relationship.
Judge Duffy's question, I think, was, is it reasonable for the jury to infer the organization that you're suggesting can be inferred if the prosecutor's argument was this was one transaction, if they weren't asked to do that?
If I recall correctly from listening to the prosecutor's closing arguments, is that he made reference to that transaction, but if I recall correctly, he also made reference to the time span and the repetition.
So two points on this. I'm understanding the state to argue today that the conspiracy involved intent to distribute beyond defendant. So we should not just look at the transaction between seller and defendant.
Correct.
Okay. And then come back to me on that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So with regards...
Oh, sorry, I remembered my second one. I don't mean to interrupt you as you were just getting ready to go. So none of this was argued by defendant in the brief. So...
Correct.
Going back to that for a second, I think the concern was the intent element of conspiracy satisfied, because the court has a duty to raise sufficiency issues sua sponte. And so the state's position on that is simply the intent is satisfied because we can look at the other evidence in the record and infer the defendant intended to distribute beyond himself.
So I'm going to narrow your question just a little bit. There are two intents that they have to find. The first isn't an intent to agree, and I think that there's sufficient evidence on the record that they were agreed upon the wholesale supplier mailing materials to the defendant. So the second part is really that second intent is the intent to commit distribution. The unique circumstances of it being in a jail and contraband being introduced into a jail, the phone calls that were entered into the record, testimony from the warden, Mark Gallegos, and his statement that that jail staff regularly tried to stop Suboxone from coming in, and that other materials or other contraband was found in other envelopes, I think can support a market-based intent to commit distribution on behalf of defendant. I don't think that the state has to prove, calling a particular detainee, oh, he sold drugs to me. I think that it can be inferred from the evidence that was presented to the jury that it was he intended on either cutting the Suboxone or trading it for other materials.
Thank you, counsel.
Then with regards to the court's second question, both the text of the statute and the jury instruction decide sufficiency. However, if the court does determine that the jury instruction is flawed, then it determines sufficiency based on that flawed instruction. Going to Judge Ray's question earlier, what is the nature of the flaw, or what is the nature of the argument? If you look at the jury instruction, it is on record proper 163, there are two errors. One is the inclusion of two extra verbs that should not have been included, transferred and deposited. Transferred is actually, it doesn't pick up anywhere. It would have been transported from the prison subsection of the statute, and deposited does pull straight from the prison subsection of the statute. So that's the first error, is that those two were erroneously included. The second error is that it does not delineate from into the jail as opposed to into the confines of the jail. And even presuming that it was the confines of the jail, the state believes that there is sufficient evidence to meet that flawed jury instruction based on what was presented at trial. Specifically, there are two main arguments. One is in pari materia under New Mexico law, and one is persuasive.
Just really quickly, we've moved on to remedy. Is the state conceding fundamental error in the jury instruction?
Frankly, I don't believe that there. If the court were to find error, that's where it would be. However, I don't think that I think that the jury could have still arrived at a correct verdict based on the instruction that they had. Because the two verbs are superfluous, they're still carried from the jail subsection of the statute and into the jail, on the lay person's understanding, automatically means into the confines of a jail.
So I think we can all agree that the instruction that was given was an erroneous instruction based on the crime that was charged. And so I'm concerned that the misuse of the transferring language in place of transporting shouldn't have been given at all, because that's not part of the crime that was charged. But But the transferring, I think, is problematic because the jury could probably agree that if defendant conspired with a person outside the jail, the act of mailing would satisfy transferring. What I don't see is how any of that would satisfy the one verb that applies to this charge, which is carrying. Okay. And I'm concerned that the erroneous instruction would have allowed the jury to conclude that it was met, not based on carrying, but based on transferring.
So there is New Mexico case law, and there are older cases, State v. Faggard and State v. Archuleta, operating under an innocent agent theory, in which in Faggard and in Archuleta, it was bank employees who were conducting transactions at that defendant's request that ended up being fraud. Those individual bank employees were not criminally liable for the fraud. That all fell upon defendant. The same concept is used in State v. Curry, which is a attempt to traffic case in which the defendant tried multiple times to acquire cocaine that he had ordered and was being delivered to him FedEx. His landlady intercepted the package and took it to the local law enforcement office, but he tried multiple times to pick up the package. So that FedEx and the United States, and then here, the United States Postal Service, and frankly, the jail staff themselves were the ones who physically carried the mail into the jail. The United States Postal Service delivered the mail to the exterior of the building, which was testimony from Warden Gallegos, and then jail staff, also testimony from Gallegos, brought it into the jail, so it was physically carried.
But that's the, I'm sorry.
Please.
That's the attempt to traffic. It's not bringing contraband into a jail.
That is bringing contraband into a jail.
That was the charge in Curry?
No, sorry.
Yeah,
I
didn't
understand the question. The Curry charge was attempt to traffic.
Okay.
And the question on appeal there was possession, because he never physically got the drugs in his possession. And the Curry court held that, yes, he had, because he had ordered it and several times had tried to possess it.
I'm going to ask what I hope is not a ridiculous question. The act of carrying, if we read subsection B strictly, the charge is bringing contraband into a jail consists of knowingly and voluntarily carrying contraband into the confines of a jail. And so it seems like if somebody is in the jail already, they're not going to be able to carry something into the jail. So I'm wondering if this simply applies to people like visiting the jail or a defendant upon conviction when they're booked into the jail. But how does it apply to somebody who's already in the jail? Has it ever been applied to somebody who's already in the jail?
Not in New Mexico. And the state would ask the court to broadly interpret that statute to prevent defendants and detainees from mailing drugs to themselves. It's not, you know, being in custody at a jail is not an opportunity to get DoorDash.
Why does an attempt to traffic cover that?
Or accomplice liability.
Right.
Right.
Why is it not an attempt to traffic?
Wouldn't attempt to traffic cover the situation that you're concerned about rather than broadening this statute's language?
Only because there are not... Attempt to traffic doesn't cover the whole scenario of bringing the... If we take the phone calls out completely and there is just the FedEx or the USPS piece of mail coming in and some other fact that showed it was ordered by defendant, then I think that stays as contraband.
But in this case, defendant wasn't charged as an accessory. I saw that word in the brief in chief, but there's no indication that the jury was instructed on accessory liability. So would accessory liability to bringing contraband into the jail cover the situation that you're worried about rather than broadening the statute?
Either accessory liability or the innocent agent under State v. Faggard and Archuleta.
Okay. But you agree that wasn't the theory presented to the jury in this case?
I believe that there's a reasonable inference that the jury said, well, that they made in that the mail showed up at the jail, went into the jail, was intercepted by jail staff, and would have made it back to defendant had it not been intercepted.
But part of the problem with... I don't disagree that the jury might have made that inference, but I think they were helped along by the prosecutor quite a lot when the prosecutor said in closing, he caused to be carried, he caused to be deposited, which sounds like accomplice. It sounds like something other than actually depositing or carrying. The jury instruction doesn't include that language. They were not instructed on accomplice liability, but they were given a way around the language of an already wrong instruction.
Had I prosecuted the case, accessory theory would be in there.
And so what does it mean that it's not?
I think that the court evaluates the jury instructions under the flawed instruction to determine whether or not there's sufficient evidence, and determines that there is, because he frankly, you know, like in Curry, wanted to FedEx. In Curry, it was FedEx cocaine, and here he was ordering Suboxone from his wholesale supplier.
So, yes, under Rosera, we would use the flawed instruction. And so if we use the flawed instruction here and we look at evidence for carry, deposit, or transfer, and what if the end result is there's only evidence of carry, or there's only evidence of one of the wrong ones, but we know, and there's no evidence of carry, right? If we review the thing and we're like, we think carry means this, and it doesn't mean what happened here. Do we remand for a new trial? In a trial we know already the evidence did not support the only viable word for the actual crime charged.
The state's position is that carry or cause to be carried are sufficient both under State v. Curry, State v. Thagard, State v. Archuleta.
Yep.
As far as sufficiency of the evidence for the flawed jury instruction.
But if that's not our determination, and that's the only one, even if there was evidence of, say, depositing, which is what the state focused on in closing argument, was depositing. If there's only evidence of depositing but no evidence of carry, we disagree about Curry, whatever would be the case. What do we do?
Then, if that's the court position, then the court's hands would be tied and would have to vacate that conviction.
Thank you.
But the state's position is that carried is supported under the innocent agent for Thagard and Archuleta and the mechanism used in State v. Curry for possession.
Right. And I think my concern about what you're describing in Curry is that it was attempt to traffic.
And if I may, because I'm seeing what the court's going to be asking. The intent for trafficking in Curry was the volume of cocaine. If I recall correctly, it was like half a pound or more. And so that automatically goes under one of those traditional indicia of trafficking, because you're not talking about a personal use amount.
My concern is actually the attempt part.
Okay.
Because that jury actually was instructed on attempt, and the question was, what I'm sure, whether those elements of attempt were satisfied by someone else getting it X far, right? And here we don't have the attempt or the accomplice instruction for that to be what we're looking at. We're not looking at whether it's okay that someone else got it this far, and we're not looking to infer a desire. We're not looking to infer the same things. So how does it work when we don't have those instructions?
Under a review by Rosaire, the flawed.
Right. So we're trying to, at this point, I think in this flowchart, we're using Curry and the innocent. What did you call it? No, innocent agent. The other one. Is that still innocent agent?
It is okay. Under that's the terminology used
in the older cases. Mm-hmm. So we're using Curry to try to establish that there was sufficient evidence to show carry, but we're doing it without an attempt or an accomplice foothold, which was present in Curry. How do we do that?
So if you look at Rosaire, they analyzed the decision in Post. If it was, well, actually, they analogized evidence that had been admitted that should have been and found on appeal that it should have been suppressed as a similar situation for a jury instruction, a flawed jury instruction that went forward, and that's the sufficiency. With regards to the court's question,
because we're not even looking at a flawed jury instruction that includes attempt language without a separate attempt instruction. If the instruction had been even more wrong and it had included cause to be carried, in the instruction, then we would just apply Rozier and say that's the wrong instruction. There was evidence of cause to be carried. Go back and retry, right? That's what we would do under Rozier. But that's not in the instruction. That was arguments made. And we don't have the same sort of, it's not in the instruction.
It's not in the, it's
at the end, yeah.
And then I would think that you would, the court would defer back to a fundamental error analysis. It was not raised, the verbs, the extraneous verbs was not raised at trial. Then the court would make a determination of whether or not the error occurred and whether or not it was fundamental. And then I think that if you go to, in that same related sphere under, you know, Barber, where it says shock the conscious and he's obviously innocent, which I don't think we get there with all of the jail calls, or a mistake in the process, fundamentally unfair. And I don't think that it rises to that standard.
I have a bit of a tangent on that. So this too was not raised by the defense. And so I understand the court's jurisdiction to include raising sufficiency sua sponte. Have we ever raised fundamental error sua sponte?
Not that I'm aware of.
And reached an issue not raised by defendant.
Off the top of my head, I can't give a court an answer on that. But I am making a note to research it myself to find out for a later date and time. Okay. Let's see. One other thing that I wanted just to discuss briefly is the evidence on that was raised in the brief about confinement. I think that there is sufficient evidence, which means that making it into the confines of the jail. The argument on appeal was that it didn't make it into the confines of the jail. There is... New Mexico authority using in pari materia, in which the definitions for confinement, State v. Woods addresses the definition and basically holds that confinement means in custody and is not limited to the four walls of a jail. There's other support for that. In New Mexico, State v. Duhon, in which a defendant received pre-sentence confinement credit on house arrest, and State v. Martinez, basically holding that the confines of the jail are not limited to physical walls. Mm-hmm. They analyzed it based on multiple cases of escape in which detainees or prison inmates had left during work release or and not returned to the jail. There is also persuasive authority, which has got some really lovely language outside of New Mexico, basically evaluating that the confines of the jail is not so narrowly limited as to the areas of the jail in which the detainees are housed and fed. It's any area within, there are several cases in which the booking area has been determined to be part of the jail. There's been other cases in which that the jail itself is the four walls, the four physical walls, as opposed to, you know, being limited to any area with bars. And then I believe that the only other thing there is some interesting case law outside of New Mexico from Connecticut, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Oregon, California, and SCOTUS going under that is innocent agent theory that it's presumed that if something if an item is mailed, there's a presumption of delivery. There's actually, in New Mexico case, State v. McHorse, if properly mailed, there was a presumption of delivery. And then I think that was the only other. Issue for the that I wanted to address. Any other questions from the court? The state believes, bottom line, the state believes that you can't order drugs to come into a jail, and two separate things happened. If for whatever reason, the supplier didn't mail the drugs to the defendant, then the conspiracy theory still stands, because in New Mexico, furtherance of the act is not required. It's complete upon the agreement, and we've got the agreement in spades over the course of those phone calls. And if those phone calls hadn't existed, then there was other proof showing that he basically DoorDashed drugs to the jail, then he would still have criminal liability for that. The The state would ask that both convictions be upheld.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court? Your Honors, I just want to make a couple of points. First of all, this is the first time that Mr. Sanchez Trio's counsel has been made aware of a lot of the authority that the state is relying on in this case. And there's a lot of authority that was brought up in this oral argument that was never previously brought up. The state's answer brief cites exactly two cases, Meters and Gonzalez. And so the state's reliance on oral argument at Curry and other things, the court really needs to make a proper decision. So I'm not really opposed to them bringing these things up. But I think that simply the court should consider that, you know, maybe that there were things that weren't raised on the defense that are being brought up now. The state is equally doing the same thing. That's all I really wanted to point out. Also, I just really want to focus on the fact that there's really no carrying in this case. The state is trying to rely on these theories that are imported from trafficking cases, but really what this statute requires is knowing and voluntary carrying. So in this case, a jail worker or a postal employee moving the physical package would not qualify as carrying under the statute, Your Honors. And furthermore, as far as the evidence of the further distribution, the state is relying on this market theory testimony that it didn't really explain at trial, in which it is really overselling here now. There is no evidence of any payments that were ever made. There were some that were discussed in the jail calls, supposedly. Now, the jail calls don't actually discuss these things in explicit terms, and so you have what the actual testimony is, are the jail employees interpreting the jail calls to say, well, this is actually a transaction of this sort.
But we also have the jail calls. I mean, we do have them ourselves, and our sufficiency standard,
yes, Your Honor,
is pretty forgiving.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if a reasonable inference can arise from the evidence at trial, isn't that good enough?
I think it is, but there's not that here, Your Honor. I mean, like I say, they're trying to say that there are these other things which are not there. There's no direct evidence of payments. They do have the jail calls. And what they're really relying on is essentially it's a jail, so Suboxone is going to be really valuable. But I think the testimony of the warden is that they're looking for Suboxone because it's contraband, not because it props up some kind of underground jail economy, Your Honors. Okay. And with that, if there are no questions, yes, Your Honor.
I have a question. Do you agree with the state's representations on appeal that the focus at trial on the conspiracy charge extended beyond the transaction between defendant and his seller?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
If I understood the state today to argue that the conspiracy wasn't simply limited to the transaction between the seller and defendant, the state was arguing that the conspiracy, the evidence at trial established that the conspiracy extended beyond defendant, that there was an intent to distribute beyond defendant. I was wondering if you might respond to that.
Yeah, so yes, Your Honor. I believe that at trial and in the answer brief, the state is relying on the fact that this is simply Mr. Sanchez Trio, and he's the only one who's involved in this, and that is the only distribution that's going on. And now I think they're trying to bring in other evidence of, you know, there's the presence of the drugs in this jail, and that sort of establishes a natural tendency to want to distribute it. And I guess I think while analytically that may well be very well true, and it is one of the policy considerations behind the statute prescribing in the introduction of contraband into jail, I don't think that the bringing of contraband into jail in itself constitutes a further attempt to distribute it beyond the person who originally received the materials. And I think that's really all the statute requires, regardless of whatever the contraband is. And remember that there are some forms of contraband that are only contraband if they're brought into the confines with the intent to give them to a prisoner, particularly currency or a communication device. So I guess what I'm concerned about is that what the state wants is a reading of the statute that would essentially make every attempt to bring contraband into jail a conspiracy to distribute or to traffic. Your Honor, that's essentially what they're looking for. And if there are no further questions, I'll yield my remaining time to the court.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, counsel. We very much appreciated getting to talk with you about the case today. We will endeavor to get you an opinion as soon as possible, but for now, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.